You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Today we're going to take a look at how our species became what it is. We'll talk about the features that separate us from the rest of the animal kingdom. Our guest is science writer Chip Walter. He's the author of Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. What unique traits shape and define us? Chip Walter narrows it down to six. Our big toes, our thumbs, our pharynx and throat, laughter, tears, and kissing. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for Chip Walter. You can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Chip Walter, a documentary filmmaker and former CNN bureau chief. He teaches science writing at Carnegie Mellon University and is senior manager of strategic communications and public information at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. A current contributor to Scientific American Mind, he is the author of Space Age and co-author with William Shatner of I'm Working on That. His book, Thumbs, Toes, and Tears and Other Traits That Make Us Human, is available from Walker and Company, and you'll find more information about our guest at his website, www.chipwalter.com. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Chip Walter, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. Our big toes, why are they important in the story of human evolution?
Yeah, you wouldn't think something as knobby and homely as a big toe would be very important, would it?
That, no.
It was actually one of the surprising things whenever I began first working on the book. But actually, we would not be able to stand upright if we didn't have our big toes. Every time you take a step, 30% of your weight shifts over to your big toe. So upright walking would be, well, a lot more clumsy without it, let's put it that way. And right, running or jumping or leaping, those kinds of things would be completely out of the question.
Yeah, and you know that really if you've ever had a toe injury. If
it's,
your stride is gone. It's
right, yeah. One, I think that's one of the reasons why it hurts so much whenever you stub your toe, because it's a lesson to the rest of your body. Don't do that because you
need, you need those toes.
Yeah, it really is. It set a whole lot of things in motion, really, because once you can stand upright, one of the first things that happens is that you use half the energy to get around. I mean, if other apes and primates that walk on all fours actually burn twice the energy, so that makes it a lot more difficult in an open space where our ancestors who were upright walking first lived. You know, that would have made it very difficult for them to survive. And the other thing is that you can move faster. And, you know, if you want to get away from a big cat and not end up being dinner, you know, being able to run upright is important.
Yeah. Well, when did our ancestors begin to stand up?
Well, best theories seem to indicate, fossil records seem to indicate that it was around 7 million years ago. It may have been earlier. And in fact, it's possible that big toes or something like the big toes that we have now evolved, you know, multiple times. They just weren't very useful and aren't very useful if you're in the jungle. It's much better to have feet like, you know, gorillas and chimpanzees have, which allow them to grip trees and kind of walk along trees and that sort of thing. But it was around that time that some major climate changes started to take place worldwide, and among the areas that got affected were kind of eastern northern Africa, where a lot of the jungles began to recede. Used to have rainforest as far north as London, but they began to recede, and kind of stranded groups of apes and primates out in the savanna. And it happened very slowly, you know, but as they retreated, those animals that developed a big toe stood a better chance of surviving you know, in that area, and our ancestors were among them.
Yeah. Now, sometime back, Donald Johanson and Tom Gray discovered a creature that they named Lucy.
When
did she walk the earth, and what was the significance of the discovery of Lucy?
Well, there are lots of reasons why Lucy was a big discovery, but certainly one of the big ones was no one at that time thought that there were upright walking apes that lived 3.5 million years ago, which is around that time, 3.5 to 4 million years ago. That's her era. And so that was a big surprise, because it sort of had the opinion at the time that you didn't, that a creature's didn't walk upright until they were smarter. I'm not quite sure why the thinking was like that then, but it was a big shock. And actually, it turned theories about intelligence on their heads, because maybe one of the reasons why we became more intelligent was because we walked upright. Because one of the things it did was it freed up our front paws, you know, or our hands, so that we could begin to use them to make tools. And when you begin to make tools, that also changed the way our brains evolved. And it selected for creatures that could think linearly and kind of logically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. If you ever brought anything home from IKEA and you try to put it together and you don't put A and connect it to B and B to C, you know, you figure out real fast that if you can't do that kind of linear thinking, you get into a lot of trouble. So tool making requires that. But the interesting thing is that that kind of thinking is also required to make sentences and to use language. It's the same kind of brain structure.
Yeah.
So in a way, our big toes are even linked to the fact that we can talk.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Oh, I guess another link that's interesting is that when we stood upright, it dropped our voice boxes lower in our throats because our neck straightened up. And that kind of odd voice box that we have, which is unique, and allows us to make more noises with our throats than any other creature, you know, is really what one of the things that enables us to form all the words that we form, and why we have spoken language as opposed to, say, gestural language.
Yeah. So by the act of standing up straight, our minds, our brains went off in a different direction.
Yeah. And it was really kind of one of the premises of the book was, I was doing a documentary some time ago on the evolution of intelligence, and for it I was in Africa, and I'm looking at all these interesting animals around me, and you know, for example, you look at an elephant and you go, wow, you know, the defining trait, physical trait of an elephant, unique trait, is its trunk. And I thought, if you really studied where did that trunk come from, how did it come to be, you would probably learn a lot about what makes an elephant tick. And then I wondered, I always wondered, how did we become the creatures that we became? And I thought, maybe that's the way to look at it. You know, what are the unique traits that we have that are defining, and then use those as little windows that you could go into? And I had no idea at the time exactly how revealing they would be. But yes, these kinds of physical traits, which seem so normal or even homely, like our big toe, actually shifted the course of our evolution, so that we end up being these kinds of creatures that go to the moon and paint the Sistine Chapel and, you know, write symphonies.
And make war.
Use technology, you know, the kind of, the power of our brains to make war and to do some pretty horrible things to one another, on the other hand.
Yeah. If we take a look at our physical being and our activities, and we think about how all this gives shape to what's going on inside our brains, is there a way to take some good guesses about where we're headed?
Well, the epilogue of the book is called Cyber Sapiens,
mm-hmm.
You know, Humans Version 2.0. And it's funny, books like this, you know, that deal with anthropology or evolution, often get to the point at the end of the book where they'll say, okay, so what happens next? And what I found is mostly people will say, well, what's the next kind of DNA change that's going to take place? You know, how are we going to change physically. I don't think that's evolution that's driven by DNA takes way too long for us to expect to see anything change very rapidly. I think where the real change is going to take place, and where the really rapid evolution has been taking place for, you know, the last 10,000 years, the last several hundred thousand years, is our technology. The first tool that was ever made was fashioned by Homo habilis 2 million years ago, and it was a little flint knife. And it was those hands and that brain that enabled that to be created. That set in motion a whole new kind of evolution, which is cultural evolution and made possible by our inventions. I think that's where we're going to see the major changes. What's interesting about where we are right now is that we are actually now beginning to create machines that operate at a molecular level or a cellular level. And so I think what's going to happen is, well, we already are, in a sense, melding with our technology. And in the next, you know, 30 years, we're going to see a literal melding with our technology. You know, I mean, there's a metaphorical one. Just think of how I've got two teenage daughters. They're rarely disconnected from their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a hard time getting along without our technology already.
Yeah.
In the future, I think we'll see nanotechnology that's incorporated right into the body.
Yeah. Well, it would be interesting to talk with a young person having read today Neuromancer.
Yes.
William Gibson's book.
Right.
And then go back.
Jacking in.
Yeah. Go back a generation to when I read it and thought it was really wild.
Right.
You know, and here we are, you know, we're one with the machine.
Yeah. And you see it in The Matrix and that sort of thing. I think that what's going to be even more interesting is that in reality, you won't even have to jack in. You know, you'll just, it's not an outrageous scenario to say that we'll create sort of parallel neurons that are nano-sized that could be sitting side by side with the neurons in your brain, and you just wirely switch from virtual reality to reality and back and forth, and it wouldn't be very long before the lines would be totally blurred.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you look at the science of neurobiology, your reality is completely dictated by how your neurons are sensing the world, what their perception of the world is. All you have to do is have one drink of alcohol to understand that.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, science writer Chip Walter, author of Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join our conversation this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. So we stood up thanks to our big toes, and we got moving, and then we had our hands at our sides, and they allowed us to make tools, and then that led us to language. There's a connection between tool making and language.
Yeah, I think this might have been the most surprising thing that I came across. There's a connection in a couple of ways, sort of along the lines that I mentioned before, which is that if you make a tool, I mean, if you're putting anything together, you have to put it together in sequence. So, let's just say that you're, you know, an ape man, and you're an ape woman, and you're, you know, making a tool, and you're bringing a rock down on another piece of stone, and you're making, you know, you're flaking it. I'm sorry, hang on one second. My phone was going dead there. And so you're bringing this down, and so really what you have is you have rock hit stone, and what you have is a simple sentence there. And so that mind, in order to be able to comprehend those three actions, you know, at some point we learn to internalize that sentence, those actions, into something. And we probably spoke first with our hands. There's a lot of evidence for that. I mean, you see it in children that can be taught at 8 months to gesture. What this tells you is that their brain is perfectly capable of communicating, but their voice box hasn't evolved or hasn't developed enough that they can actually do all the complex things that you have to do to make language or spoken language. I mean, there's 100 muscles at work whenever I'm making these noises at you. And so a child, you know, at that age simply isn't capable of that. But they can very effectively sign. And studies, in fact, show that the children of parents who sign, you know, because they're deaf, you know, will begin to babble using their hands at the same time that speaking children will. And they can, you know, speak very effectively with their hands. And so you can teach it to any child. And by the way, it seems to improve their ability to use spoken language later when around 14, 15 months first words get said.
Yeah. Well, now, thinking of language and thinking of culture, language in turn makes us more social. It makes us social beings, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's... You know, we probably were all already very social whenever language developed, and it's hard to know exactly when spoken language evolved because there's no way to have a fossil for it. But, you know, we're probably very, very social, and one of the reasons we were so social and why we are, in fact, the most social of all species is because, again, we were evolving on the open savanna, which is a very dangerous place. You know, the jungle is a safer place, and so you need one another. It doesn't sound like it to us, but no,
it's a savanna out there, baby.
Yeah, right.
You don't say that.
Yeah, it's not the jungle that's so bad. Yeah, but so you're out there on the savanna, and you really have to rely on one another. So you need one another, and really, when you look at the essence of humans, you know, and human relationships, we don't like to be alone. You put someone in solitary confinement, they'll lose their mind eventually if they're completely separated from other humans. So we need one, and we need one another in the sense that we need to keep kind of an eye on one another because we're competing with one another. Think of office politics. But we also need one another in the sense that families need one another. We need to support one another and help one another. And so in order to do those things, you have to be able to communicate, and you have to be able to stay in touch, and we communicate on a whole lot of different levels. Language is only really a fraction of the way that we communicate, but it's very, very important, and it is absolutely essential to our cultural evolution because language enables us to share ideas in ways, in very, very complex ways. I mean, just imagine, you know, building a bridge. Just imagine building a house. You know, it requires an enormous amount of communication going on between people, or otherwise it just wouldn't work. And so we built these, you know, enormous economies and, you know, complex technologies, and that's all essentially built on the back of our ability to speak to one another. Then you build written language on top of that, mathematics and all kinds of other ways to communicate. But it all starts with those first tools, and those first tools, you know, that made it possible for us to speak, and those tools were in turn made possible because we stood up.
Mm. And when did laughter come along?
Well, laughter is just really, laughter and crying, kissing, all three of them are very interesting because they're nonverbal forms of communication that are absolutely essential to human relationships. So take laughter. I mean, just imagine, can you imagine a close friend that you've never laughed with? I mean, almost by definition, that's how you categorize a close friend. I mean, it's someone you've had great times with, probably someone you've cried with, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I found in the research is several interesting things. One is that laughter is kind of related to the hoots and calls of the jungle. You know, or the barking of a dog, or, you know, those kind of, that's where it has its roots. And there's a great little story that Jane Goodall told about, you know, being out in the jungle, and she would put bananas out, you know, there, and then kind of watch and see what would happen. And chimpanzees have this kind of, it's called a food call, so that whenever they find food, they all automatically call out with this call. And it's probably evolved as a way to make sure that everyone shared whatever they found in the way of food. So this particular chimpanzee, you know, comes up and picks up the banana, and it starts to make this call, and it slaps its hand over its mouth to stop it, because it wants the banana for itself, you know. And I thought the fascinating thing about that was, when I thought of laughter, you're always surprised by laughter, you know. So just like that call kind of happens involuntarily, laughter happens involuntarily too. You'd never sit down and say to yourself, I think I'll laugh now. It's a fake laugh if you do that, and everyone recognizes it. Laughter is spontaneous. And the other thing that seems to be true of laughter is that when you're doing it, especially when you're doing it with other people, it seems to be a way of saying to everyone, you know what, we're all on the same page. My guard is down. We're seeing the world the same way. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's such a powerful bonding kind of activity. You know, it's why, if you do it a lot with someone, why that person is your close friend. Not because they're funny, but because you see the world in the same way. You have a lot in common with them. That's why you're laughing together. And so it's just really fascinating. And, of course, the other thing that happens with laughter is there's all sorts of brain chemistry that goes to work. It sends off endorphins that make you feel great. And, you know, it's really true. If you don't laugh on a regular basis, you know, you're going to be, well, an unhappy person.
Yeah, yeah. It was also very interesting to think about, you know, while I was reading Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, that the bond between child and parent strengthens when the little baby begins to smile and coo and giggle.
Yeah, yeah. That happens around 4 months or so. And it, I mean, one of the things that I say in the book, and it's true, I mean, anyone who's raised children, this is certainly true in the case of my children, is, you know, you spend the first 3+ months, and pretty much everything you're doing is you're just taking care of them, and the main way that they communicate with you is by crying. I mean, they'll look at you and that sort of thing. But when you see that smile for the first time, that it touches you in a way that I think almost any, it's mm-hmm. such a great experience. And it's a powerful experience for a reason, because it's a personal connection that you're making with your child. Really, an individual connection that you're making with them. And when you can make them laugh, you know, and giggle and feel happy, it's such a great feedback loop, you know. And it's one of those things, again, that is a big bonding. You know, it just bonds us. You know, it bonds us with our children, bonds us with our friends. And anyone that's done this, you know, which is most of us, you know, can just remember that first time. It's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, with any child, if you see any child and they smile and they're laughing and giggling, and this also happens between any human beings that come mm-hmm. in contact with one another, it gets back to that we're all here together,
yeah,
and we're in a comfortable space. But when you see, you know, I'm smiling thinking of it now, but if you see a little child mm-hmm. grinning ear to ear, you know, it just...
It makes you smile.
You just light up.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's really interesting. It's contagious, like yawning, you know. And so when you, if you walk in, if you see two people interacting and laughing or smiling, you will involuntarily almost always smile. It's one of the reasons why laugh tracks work. You know, it's contagious, and you know the guy that invented the laugh track, he found that if you just play people laughing, then things seem funnier and you kind of involuntarily fall in and laugh as well. So it's a very primal, you know, sort of thing. But, you know, being human and having the more complex brains that we have, we invest it with so much more feeling and, you know, memory and thought. So you and I can sit here and reflect on the power of laughter, but laughter itself is involuntary and primal.
Yeah, and everybody does it.
Everybody does it. Every culture does it. Humor is absolutely built into the species, and it's very important. And a couple of other interesting things. You would think that people laugh because they hear a joke. Turns out, you know, that a small percentage of the laughter we do is in response to a joke. It's just really, again, that we're kind of on the same page. So someone will say, I'll just make a comment when someone walks in the room. Or often, if you really watch a conversation, you'll laugh to show agreement. You know, you'll laugh just to sort of back somebody up. You know, there's all kinds of fascinating reasons why we do it. But of course, again, we're not thinking of those things because it's so built into us.
Mm. We can also do it when we're nervous, though.
Yeah, yeah. We've all seen nervous laughter, and it's very difficult to understand what that is. It's probably just like any other, you know, kind of tic or affectation someone might have. You know, some people might, you know, scratch their ear or something if they're uncomfortable or shift. But some people will laugh kind of uncomfortably, and sometimes people will fake laugh for the boss, that sort of thing, because, yeah, again, it's a way of saying, okay, you're the man. You know, I'm with you. That was really funny, man. You know, and so it becomes a form of bonding, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Or what I just did, a laugh as a form of recognition.
Right.
You know?
Because you've seen it before.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Maybe you tell us about the Laugh Lab project. And does this tell us anything about what we find funny across cultures?
Oh, yeah. Well, the whole idea of why we find something funny is fascinating. A Laugh Lab is a lab that's created in Britain. And I'm sorry, the name of the scientist is escaping me right now, but he basically put out on the internet the call to everyone that came to the site, said, tell us your funniest joke, you know. And then they also called a bunch of jokes, and then they put them up, and then they asked people to vote on what they thought was the funniest joke. And I won't go into telling what was the funniest joke, but it's actually kind of dark. And one of the reasons why they felt that it was funny, and this does seem to be something that's true about what happens in the brain when we think something's funny, is that our mind is headed in one direction, and then suddenly it gets kind of whipsawed by, you know, the punchline, which takes us in a completely other, unexpected direction. And there's a little part of our brain right above our eyebrows in the middle of our head that seems to be the place where we get the joke, you know, whenever the punchline's delivered. And it's at that moment where you go in the opposite direction that you involuntarily laugh, you know, and you have this kind of hoot that comes out of you. And so surprise seems to be a key thing. And really, when you think about the first laughter, when you really get your little baby going,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like peekaboo or,
yeah.
you know, you're surprising them. You know, and one theory is that laughter's evolution really is based on crying first, you know, and that you're unhappy, and then you're suddenly surprised to find that you're not safe, and therefore, you know, and this is going back to the beginning of evolution of laughter, you know, if you're a baby, then you may have been crying because you're uncomfortable, but then suddenly you realize that you're safe, and so there's this kind of hoot that comes out, and that seems to be, you know, what happens with a joke. We're headed in one direction, we think, oh, we're going this way, and then bang, we're going the other way, and we find it funny, you know, whatever funny is, and we laugh.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. On the program today, we're taking a look at how our species became what it is. We're talking about the features that separate us from the rest of the animal kingdom, including our big toes, our thumbs, and our ability to laugh, cry, and kiss. Our guest is Chip Walter, author of Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, babies cry to get our attention, but why do we keep crying, and why do tears spill from our eyes when we cry?
Yeah, well, it's a mystery. It is unique to us. We are the only creatures on the planet, even though there are some apocryphal stories about elephants, that cry tears of emotion. I mean, you can, you know, if you poke an animal in the eye, then it will certainly tear up because it hurts. And if you do that to us, it'll happen too. But no other creature cries out of sadness or pride or, you know, any other strong emotion. And so at some point in our evolution, our tear ducts, the nerve endings that are connected to our tear ducts, are also connected to the emotional parts of our brain that can cause us to cry. And it's certainly when we're children, it's the main way. I mean, babies, it's the main way that we communicate. I mean, really, baby has no other recourse, really. Later, we certainly hang on to it because it works. It gets attention, but tears seem to add an exclamation point to crying. I mean, other animals will whimper and howl and that sort of thing, and we know they're unhappy when they do that. But humans are capable of deception. Tears seem to be a way to kind of eliminate any possibility that you're deceiving someone about how much trouble you're in. When you see tears rolling down the face of your children, you know, I mean, sometimes they'll fall on skin and knee and they'll sort of cry, and you involuntarily and probably unconsciously check to see if tears are coming out of their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
If they aren't, you probably go, you're fine, it's okay. But if, you know, real tears are coming out of their eyes, you know they're probably seriously hurt or seriously feeling pain. And later, we just kind of take that physical pain, and if we're feeling emotional pain, you know, then we sometimes get upset enough that we cry. Or if we're witnessing other people in pain, or watching a movie or reading a book. It seems that tears may have remained with us, evolved, and work so well because they become this way of saying, I really, really am in trouble. It's only a handful of actors can kind of cry on cue. It's very difficult for most of us to do. So it's a way of saying what you're feeling is authentic. And therefore, because we're very social and because we need one another, it's a way of calling out and saying, help me.
Mm. Sometimes we might find ourselves saying, I laughed so hard I cried.
Right.
And a good laugh is great, and a good cry is great as well. Both are cathartic.
Yeah, boy, that's so true. It's a great question. There's various theories about, you know, the advantages of crying. One theory is that we actually cry the kind of bad chemicals in our brain out. You know, the brain chemistry takes, you know, a certain brain chemistry that takes place whenever you're feeling sad and upset, and particularly if you're upset enough to cry. And, you know, if you actually do the chemistry on tears that come out of our eyes whenever we're crying, there are certain hormones that are in it that can affect mood and make you feel badly. And so that's one theory. Chances are that's not the case because whenever, you know, if you have a really big cry, there's less than a teaspoon of water that's coming out of your eyes. So we're probably not crying out all those hormones. The other idea is that it's really kind of a thermostat, and it's a rheostat. You know, it's a way of getting us back to feeling normal, and so there's an internal chemistry that says, "I'm crying. I'm feeling these things. The brain chemistry is at work here. We need to get back to, you know, normalcy." And the truth is, if we weren't able to do that, then we probably wouldn't have survived, because if you're upset all the time, you probably can't think straight and you get eaten. So,
yeah.
That seems to be one of its roles.
I wonder when and where and what it was like our first attempts at theater.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I thought a lot about that. There wasn't really room in the book to deal with it. So many questions that come up about these sorts of things. But we do seem to be compelled to tell stories. And our brain seems to be wired to listen to stories. And one of the reasons that one of the things that makes a story great is emotion. Because on a very primal level, that's what we truly connect with. I mean, that's one reason why There's hundreds of millions of dollars that are made on blockbuster movies as opposed to PBS documentaries. I mean, you know, one is just simply more abstract and the other one is more emotional. I'm not saying which one's better. I'm just saying that that's the way we kind of built. And so we seem to want to tell stories, and the more emotional we make those stories, the more people connect to them. And so I would think that it wouldn't have taken very long for people that were telling stories, early stories, to figure out that if you wanted to keep everyone tuned in, you know, you have to keep them emotional, you have to keep the stakes high, you know, and then people will really pay attention. And because we are so tight with one another and we're so capable of sympathizing and empathizing, which is a very important trait that we have, we get really tuned in if the story is something we can relate to.
Yeah, and it's also important in our evolution because with stories we can inform one another and tell one another about their lessons, and we can also say, you know, up the road there's trouble.
Right. Yeah. Let me tell you about the big mastodon I brought down today, and there's, you know, other ones we got to watch out for. Or, by the way, here's a great way to bring the mastodon down. You know, so you're teaching by telling stories too. There's so many things that go on whenever you're telling stories, and so much of our culture is really about telling stories. I mean, think about the day-to-day conversations you have with people. You know, most of them are not about, you know, how you operate the telephone or how you even do a particular job. I mean, mostly what they're about is, well, I talked to my mother last night, or my boyfriend's really, you know, ticking me off, or, you know, I couldn't believe the boss said this. You know, but again, as you say, everyone's learning from all of those things. They're either learning things about themselves or the boss or about you, you know, because you're the person that's telling the story. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, now, before we run out of time, we've got to talk about kisses. One of the epigraphs you use to open this section of the book is this: kisses are like tears. The only real ones are the ones you can't hold back.
Yeah, that's a great quote, isn't it? It's true, too. Kissing seems to be this primal form of nonverbal communication, which sounds like a terrible way to describe a kiss, but it is a powerful form of communication. I wrote a piece for Scientific American Mind about kissing recently, and this was not in the book. There's a recent piece of research that shows that, at least among college-age students, and I think I venture to guess this is true across the board, that one bad kiss, you know, a first bad kiss, could kill a relationship in its tracks. And the reason why is not just because it's an awkward kiss, but because there's so much that's being communicated whenever we kiss. You know, it's like you can tell whether someone's comfortable with you. You can tell whether you connect, literally. You know, your body language, the pheromones that may be moving back and forth, the body chemistry that's taking place whenever two people kiss. And it's powerful because your lips and tongue are the most sensitive parts of the body. One of the interesting things that I came across in doing research of the book is 10% of the human race still doesn't kiss. It's probably a little less than that now. And that's 650 million people, roughly, which is, if it were a nation, would make it the third largest country on the planet. So that's a lot of people that still don't kiss, and that tells us that it's learned. It's not like laughter and crying. It's not something that's built into our DNA. And it's not cross-cultural, although it's almost, you know, completely cross-cultural. But one thing that seems to be true is that whenever someone learns it, it catches on really fast.
Yeah, it's a pretty good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's powerful. It's so powerful. And I think it's kind of a testament to our inventiveness, you know, And it's a great thing. And whenever you really want to lay one on someone, you know, it's something you all like. You know, like the quote says, you can't control. Got to do it.
Yeah. And, you know, when you stop to think about it, these things you might realize, but it was fun to come across them in your book. A kiss can relieve stress, of course. Or it could,
yeah.
or if it's not very good, it could up your stress level, I'm sure.
Right.
But
yeah, how do I get out of this?
Yeah,
one?
I was like, oh boy, this is not so good. Right. Burning calories and increasing self-esteem.
Yeah. Well, you know, you burn calories because you use a lot of muscles in your face whenever you're kissing. But and generally, if you're involved in necking, it's not the only part of your body that's moving. And it just creates literally heat. I mean, some of these things that we say about I have great chemistry, there's a lot of heat between those two people. Those are things that are actually true biologically as well as metaphorically. And so we burn up calories. There's all kinds of brain chemistry that's going on when we kiss. Floods of endorphins. Almost every kind of hormone that makes you feel good is at work. It sets in motion. Your endocrine system goes into overdrive, and it sets all sorts of other things in motion physically. And basically, it's preparing you for mating. It's the thing that's getting you revved up and ready for that, which is, why we have to have those conversations with our teenage kids.
Yeah.
And it's also, but like the quote says, sometimes you can't stop yourself. It's primal. It's primal in the sense that, there's a lot of subconscious stuff that goes on that we don't really have a lot of control over once it gets set in motion.
Yeah, it's deliciously dangerous.
That's a great way to put it.
When you're at that point in life when you're discovering that kissing is a great thing you're not going to get cooties.
No. And I mean, assuming that your first kiss is a good kiss, just think of how memorable it is, and think of how connected you are with that person, and the thrill of it. It's pretty great. All six of these things are things that make you feel happy to be human.
Yeah. Why did scientists have to come up with a scientific term for kissing? Osculation.
I don't know. I mean, I wish that I could. I think that everyone has to have jargon, for everything that they do. It's one way to kind of make things seem important. But kissing, just the word kissing would have sufficed for me. Maybe they got tired of using the same term again and again, needed to come up with a synonym. There aren't very many synonyms for kissing, so it probably tells us how important and unique it is.
Smooching? What else would that be?
But they all have subtly different differences. Lip locking or snoggling, is, you come across in Harry Potter all the time.
Yeah. Well, osculation sure is very...
Yeah.
It's very scientific.
Yeah, can I osculate you?
Yeah.
It's kind of self-defeating.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. Is there a story that you'd like to tell us, or is there some way that you would like to wind up here this afternoon?
Well, I suppose the only thing that I can say is that I don't think I'm unusual in being fascinated with the creatures that we are. I think that the mistake that we all make is that we take ourselves for granted because, as I said at the very beginning of the book, being human, why would we think it's extraordinary to be a human being? But it is extraordinary to be a human being, and really what I try to do in the book is say, look, just look out there at the rest of the world. We do some horrible things, we absolutely do. We do some wonderful things. And we're not necessarily top of the heap or better than any other particular animal, but we have changed everything. And we are an amazing creature. And it's fun and interesting and revealing to figure out how we got to be that way. And that's really what the book is about. How did that come to be, and what does it mean? And then hopefully you can get to the end of the book and say, I'll be a better human being as a result of reading it.
Mm. Also, I think for me, it gave me a new appreciation or it gave me some time to ponder how it is that we have the ability to awe to be in awe.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many remarkable things about our world.
Right, and we are such a complex creature. Just the feeling awe, you know, it takes a primal drive. It takes brains. And I think that's the most interesting thing about us, is we are this fusion of high intelligence and these primal drives that are not let go. I mean, our DNA goes back billions of years, you know, and so we're carrying, you know, the history of how we got to where we are, and then you layer this intelligence over top of it, and it's powerful, and therefore we're the only ones that can sit here and look back on that and have developed the science to figure out how we got here, or even begin to figure it out. And so we can reflect on these things, and that's what makes us a whole other creature.
Mm. Chip Walter, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
That was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Chip Walter is the author of Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. The publisher is Walker & Company, and you'll find more information about our guest at his website, www.chipwalter.com.